The Katra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're tackling a really significant work, Alexis de Tocqueville's Democracy in America. It's from the 19th century, but honestly, we're looking at it almost like a prophecy for today.
Absolutely. It dives into this huge fundamental question, one that you probably think about quite a bit.
Yeah.
What actually happens when democratic equality becomes, well, the main organizing principle for everything, for society, culture, even, you know, how we think?
Right. Tocqueville saw this shift as, well, he called it this unstoppable, almost God-given force. And he really wanted to figure out what's the cost.
Mm-hmm.
And what strikes me really is how incredibly relevant it still feels. He wasn't just looking at, say, the American government structure. He was digging into the spirit of a democratic age.
Yeah, the psychology of it all.
Exactly. And his warnings about things like conformity, the creeping power of central government, even this kind of spiritual hollowness you get from extreme individualism, it feels so current, maybe even more so now than, say, 50 years ago. It's kind of a roadmap for understanding the democratic mindset, both its strengths and its weaknesses.
Definitely. And to really get his analysis, it helps to know a bit about the man himself. Alexis de Tocqueville, born 1805. He came from a very specific background.
French aristocracy, right?
Yes, exactly. A French aristocrat whose family actually went through some pretty rough times during the French Revolution. So he wasn't necessarily nostalgic for the old ways, but he had a very clear view of what this new democratic wave was replacing. You know, the old traditions, the rigid social structures.
That perspective is so crucial, isn't it? It let him look at democracy without maybe rose-tinted glasses. He wasn't emotionally invested in the American system being perfect. He was analytical.
Purely analytical. So in 1831, he travels to America. Now, the official reason given was to study the prison system.
Which he did do, but...
But his real goal was much bigger. He basically used the U.S. as a giant living laboratory. He saw America as the most developed example of this democratic revolution that was sweeping the globe.
So by studying America, he felt he was looking into the future.
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah.
The future of the world, as he saw it. Mm-hmm. And being an outsider, an analytical observer, it gave his work this real rigor, this detail. And honestly, sometimes it's pretty blunt.
Okay, so let's dig into the book itself, Democracy in America. It wasn't just like, here's what I saw on my trip. It was meant to educate people back in Europe, especially in France, about this massive, unavoidable shift towards equality.
And the sheer scope is incredible. He covers everything from, you know, how local governments work, right down to family dynamics and social custom.
It's published in two volumes, right? And they have slightly different focuses.
That's right. Volume I came out first, it's more political, more descriptive. It looks at the institutions, federalism, the courts, local power, and it introduces his first big warning sign, the tyranny of the majority.
We'll definitely come back to that one. And volume two.
Volume two came a few years later, and that's the one that, as you said, really gets inside our heads. It's more sociological, philosophical. It looks at the cultural impact. So thinking, manners, exactly. Intellectual life, social habits, the rise of what he called individualism, another key concept. And then maybe his most famous idea, that really quite chilling prediction of soft despotism.
Okay, so if you had to boil it down, what's the core argument across both volumes?
Well, fundamentally, he's saying democracy has this amazing potential, right, for human flourishing. But it also contains these really powerful, unique dangers baked right in.
And the central conflict is liberty versus equality.
Precisely. How do you balance individual freedom with this relentless, almost crazed passion for equality? You're really worried that if people felt they had to choose, they'd often pick equality, especially material comfort and sameness over actual liberty.
That's unsettling. Okay, let's dive into Volume I a bit deeper. He makes a really interesting point about where American liberty actually started, not in Philadelphia with the Constitution necessarily.
No, he traces it back way earlier to the local level. To understand America, he says you have to look at its origins, specifically the self-governing practices of the early New England settlers.
He puts a huge emphasis on the New England township, doesn't he?
Oh, absolutely critical. He calls it the School for Democratic Citizenship. And it's a great phrase because it captures the idea perfectly. This is where ordinary people stop being just subjects and learn to be active citizens.
Because they have to, right? They're forced to engage.
Exactly. They have to cooperate. They have to debate. They have to solve shared problems. Roads, schools, whatever it is, working directly with their neighbors. It's this hands-on mandatory engagement that he saw as the best defense against you know, the state just taking over everything.
So the township builds the habit of self-rule. What about checks on raw popular power?
That's where he brings in the judiciary and lawyers. It's fascinating. He saw the legal profession as a kind of stabilizing, almost conservative force within democracy.
Conservative in what sense? Like slowing things down?
Yeah, precisely. He noticed that in America, almost every big political fight eventually gets framed as a legal issue. It gets channeled into the courts.
Ah, so it turns political questions into judicial ones.
Right. And that process forces these raw, often emotional popular demands to be filtered through logic, procedure, respect for precedent. It puts the brakes on, provides stability against sudden, impulsive decisions by the majority.
Which brings us to the big danger he flags in Volume 1, the tyranny of the majority. And it's important to clarify, he doesn't mean a king locking you up.
No, it's much more insidious than that. It's social pressure. It's the power of public opinion.
A tyranny over thought, almost.
Exactly. The majority doesn't just control the government through votes. It dictates what's acceptable to even think or say. He had that really stark observation. He said he knew of no country in which there is so little independence of mind as America.
Wow. Why did he think that?
Because, he argued, people fear social isolation, being shunned, losing their reputation, becoming an outcast far more than they fear, say, a small fine or some minor legal trouble.
So the fear of sticking out is the real enforcer.
Yes. That social conformity crushes dissent long before the law even needs to get involved. It makes people self-censor.
That fear, that pressure to conform, it feels like a perfect lead-in to Volume 2 and his concept of individualism. And you stressed earlier, this isn't just being selfish.
Not at all. He's very clear on that distinction. Selfishness is an age-old vice, right? Mm. Just thinking about yourself. Individualism, for Tocqueville, is something newer, something specific to democracy.
So what is it then?
It's more like a failure of civic connection. It's this calm, considered decision to withdraw from public life. You retreat into your own small circle family, close friends.
You just focus on your private world.
Right. You basically decide to leave society at large to itself. You feel responsible only for your immediate connections.
And the danger there is...
Well, think about it. If millions of individuals all pull back from civic life at the same time, if they stop participating, stop paying attention, what happens?
There's a power vacuum.
Exactly. And who fills that vacuum? The state. Power naturally concentrates in a central authority when citizens voluntarily step back.
Which connects back to that relentless drive for equality you mentioned.
Yes. It's all interconnected. Tocqueville saw the desire for equality as almost bottomless. Once you get political equality, people demand social equality, then economic equality. There's this constant push to level conditions.
Okay, but how do you achieve that constant leveling without a huge amount of government control?
That's the crux of it. In his view, you really can't manage that perpetual drive for equality without a very powerful, very active, constantly expanding central government stepping in to manage things.
And that's where dependency creeps in.
That's the moment. You start trading away your local control, your individual initiative, maybe even some freedoms, in return for the perceived comfort and security that this big paternalistic state promises to provide.
But he did offer some hope, right? An antidote to this isolating individualism.
Yes, absolutely. He identified civil associations as incredibly important. These are just voluntary groups. Could be businesses, churches, clubs, charities, anything where people come together voluntarily.
And why are they so vital? He called them great free schools of democracy, didn't he?
He did.
Yeah.
Because they force people to learn what he called the science of association.
Mm-hmm.
You have to learn to cooperate with people you don't know well, people outside your family.
To work towards a common goal.
Right. It teaches cooperation, builds trust beyond your immediate circle, and it directly pushes back against that isolating tendency of individualism. They're like democracy's essential training ground and maybe its shock absorbers.
And underneath all the formal structures, the laws, the associations, he kept coming back to something deeper. Mores over laws.
Mm-hmm. Mores. It's a great word. It means the customs, the values, the shared beliefs, what he beautifully called the habits of the heart.
The sort of unwritten rules and attitudes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He argued that ultimately a democracy's success depends more on these underlying mores than on its written constitution or its political setup. Do people have the internal discipline, the civic virtue, to govern themselves without needing a heavy hand from above?
And religion played a role here for him.
It did, but in a specific way. Not as a state-sponsored church, but as a separate moral force that encouraged self-restraint, responsibility, thinking beyond just immediate gratification. It helped shape those necessary habits of the heart.
Tocqueville was amazing at crystallizing these complex ideas into really memorable phrases. We should probably touch on a few of those famous quotes.
Definitely. One of my favorites, tying back to what we just discussed about associations, is, in democratic countries, the science of association is the mother of science.
Oh, that's powerful. What's he really saying there?
He's saying that this basic skill, the ability to organize yourselves, to work together voluntarily, is fundamental. It's the bedrock upon which all other kinds of success in a democracy are built, whether that's economic innovation or political stability. If you can't associate, you can't really succeed democratically.
Okay, wow. And then there's the really famous and frankly quite scary imagery he uses for soft despotism. He doesn't picture a dictator with an iron fist.
No, it's much subtler. He describes his future government as like a kindly shepherd caring for its flock of timid and industrious animals.
That image is just chilling. It captures his fear perfectly, doesn't it? It's not about violent oppression.
No, it's about being smothered with care. A paternalistic state that gives you everything you need, manages every detail, removes all risk, and in doing so, keeps citizens in a state of perpetual childhood.
So liberty isn't crushed, it's just managed away. You trade agency for comfort.
Precisely. You become passive and dependent. And maybe one more quote, often paraphrased, but it gets at the fiscal risks. He warned that the Republic will last until the day Congress discovers that it can bribe the public with the public's money.
Oof. Talk about foresight. That cuts right to the heart of worries about political pandering, using public funds to create dependency and secure votes.
It really does. It's about that dangerous loop of dependency and debt.
What's incredible is taking these ideas from the 1830s and seeing how well they apply now. Let's think about the tyranny of the majority in our digital age.
Yeah, it maps almost perfectly, doesn't it? Instead of worrying about what people in your small town think.
Now you worry about the global online crowd getting canceled, being piled on, having your reputation shredded instantly online. That fear of social shame is amplified massively.
It absolutely is. And does the anonymity online make it better or worse? I suspect worse, because the attacks can come from anywhere, often without consequence for the attacker.
It makes it so much harder to hold an independent thought, doesn't it? When the majority opinion seems to be screaming at you from every screen.
It really discourages that intellectual independence he valued so highly.
And his solution for individualism, the need for association, feels like direct advice for combating modern loneliness, doesn't it?
Totally. He's basically saying the cure isn't just introspection or therapy. It's action. It's getting involved.
Get off the internet, join a local group. Volunteer for something.
Right. Practice actually cooperating and building things with real people in your community, people who aren't just like you or who you already know. That builds the civic muscle.
And finally, that warning about soft despotism, it gives us a critical lens for looking at government actions today, doesn't it? Especially when they're framed in terms of safety or convenience.
Absolutely. We constantly need to ask, is this policy, this program, actually empowering people to be more capable, more self-reliant? Or is it subtly encouraging passivity and dependence? Is it making us stronger citizens or just more comfortable subjects?
So wrapping this up, if listeners take away one big thing from Tocqueville, what do you think it should be?
For me, it's his relentless focus on culture over just structure. You can design the most brilliant constitution, set up perfect institutions, but if the underlying culture, the mores, the habits, the spirit of the citizens isn't strong, if people become too passive, too isolated, too focused only on their own comfort,
the whole democratic project is at risk.
Exactly. The biggest threats aren't usually external, they're internal. They come from within the democratic soul itself.
Okay, so here's a final thought to leave you with, something Tocqueville really pushes us to consider. The greatest dangers to our liberty often don't look like obvious tyranny. They look like comfort, convenience, conformity. They arrive when we willingly trade away our active participation, our agency, for a sense of security or ease. So the question he leaves us with is, are you actively practicing the skills of self-governance in your own life and community? Or have you, maybe without even realizing it, started to prefer being one of those timid and industrious animals in the flock? That's the challenge he throws down.
A profound challenge indeed.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Acontra Foundation.